It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, Alcoa moves its headquarters back to Pittsburgh next Friday. We'll talk about that impact. But first, when is a budget not really a budget? When the revenue side doesn't mesh with the spending side. 2 months after agreeing on a $32 billion spending plan, there is still no agreement on how to fund it. That means borrowing to pay the bills and maybe a spending freeze. Joining us from Harrisburg is John Micek. John is the opinion editor for Penn Live and the Harrisburg Patriot News. Welcome, John. Good to talk to you.
Kevin, how's it going?
It's going well. If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. On August 16th, the Pennsylvania Treasury provided a $750 million loan to the general fund to the state to pay its bills. It was to pay back the loan with interest this week. John, you've covered and observed Harrisburg for some time now. The borrowing of money, is that all that unusual?
Well, thanks for reminding me about how long I've been doing this. I heard the ad for the handcrafted vodka during the promos. I think I might need a shot to help deal with what we're going through now, Kevin. But no, it's not all that unusual for the states to borrow money to get through a budget shortfall. It's happened many times in the past, and the state has always repaid the money to the state treasury. The caucuses, for instance, have been extended lines of credit during protracted budget crunches. But you've hit the nail on the head here. I mean, here we are 2 months into the fiscal year. And while there is a spending plan in place, there is still absolutely no agreement on how to pay for this. That is a reversal to where we were in 2015, where there was not a general fund budget in place for agreed to general fund budget in place for some 9 months of Governor Tom Wolf's first term. So it's a very unusual dynamic.
I spoke with the deputy treasurer, Jack Stolzheimer, on Tuesday, and he told me that the amount and this early into the fiscal year, as far as borrowing goes, is unprecedented. Let's listen.
We're having to borrow more and more money earlier and earlier into the budget year because of the structural deficit that the Pennsylvania state government is facing. We're predicting, based upon current trends and conditions, that almost two-thirds of this coming fiscal year, the Commonwealth's budget will be underwater. Our projections show that general fund is going to become negative again in September.
And that means going back to the Treasury, seeking another loan in about a week or so. John, is the state engaged in sort of a payday loan cycle? Get a loan against your expected incoming money. When you get your paycheck, or in this case, your tax revenues, you pay it back.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're playing chicken with the taxpayers' finances here. I mean, there's no better way to explain it than that. The failure to address the structural deficit has led to threats of credit downgrades from Moody's and other rating agencies. What that means, in essence, for the average listener is that it becomes more expensive for the state to borrow money, and that cost inevitably gets passed along. Governor Tom Wolf has been railing for, frankly, years now about the need for the state to stop going for one-time fixes and short-term fixes and to get the state onto more fiscal stable ground. It's true. I mean, just like anybody else, you can't borrow against your paycheck and not expect to pay, to face some cost for that.
And Stolzheimer said there is a cost, even though the state is, in a sense, borrowing from the state, in a sense, it does have to pay it back with interest.
That's correct. And that's money that comes out of other programs, frankly. If you're paying money to pay back interest, that's money that could have been spent on schools. It's money that could have been spent on roads and bridges and state police and all the stuff that we think is important to spend money on. Instead, you're just dumping it down a hole because of your own mismanagement.
All right. So the Senate on, I believe it was July 27th, approved a revenue package, barely in their vote. But House leadership has yet to present a plan for vote. What do you see as the holdup here in the lack of House action?
Look, so the ball is entirely in the House's court on this one. They've been dithering for weeks trying to come up with some kind of counterproposal. And even as recently as, say, 9:30 this morning, there is still nothing for them to present. And they'd vowed to present one by month's end. And today is August 25th, and the meter is running. So that's sort of the topography right now. The issue is this, is there's simply not enough votes in the House right now, or so we're led to believe, on this suite of tax increases that are included in the Senate bill. One of them is a severance tax on natural gas drillers that the Senate finally accepted after the Wolf administration plugged it for years. The other one is a built-in tax on consumers' utility bills, on your landline telephone, on natural gas, on electricity. It's known as the gross receipts tax. The House thinks that's an unfair tax on consumers, and I have some sympathy to that argument. The severance tax is booked for about 100-something million in its first year. The gross receipts tax is booked for 400-something million. That number is backwards in my estimation, and so I am sort of sympathetic to the arguments there. But so far, all the House has been good at is saying no. They've not said what they're for, and frankly, it's on them now to say what they're for to get the state out of this mess.
How does this reflect on the House Republican leadership, on Speaker Turzheim and on Leader Reid, that they can't sort of get their people in line?
I wouldn't want to be Dave Reed for all the tea in China. The Republicans wished for a large majority. This is a case of being careful what you wish for. They expanded their majority, but that's just that many more cats that they're going to have to herd. And most of them are fiscally conservative cats who are deathly averse to tax increases of any kind. It's a management problem for Reed, who is the presiding officer, or who is the ranking Republican floor leader. But it's also a contrast in visions between Reed and Turzheim. Mike Turzheim is absolutely wedded to the complete privatization of Pennsylvania's liquor store system. That is something that the Senate has repeatedly said that it's not interested in this year, but he's kept plugging away on that. Reed has had to contend with that conflicting message coming out, and it's a very weird dynamic over there.
On Wednesday, seemingly frustrated Governor Wolf indicated he could freeze spending as early as mid-September.
I ran a business. Mm-hmm. At some point, the bank or somebody says, you got to stop doing this. We have ratings agencies out there that are about to downgrade Pennsylvania's debt because of this irresponsible behavior. The easiest thing to do is just get back, finish the job. Everybody else has done this.
All right, everybody else has done this, but the House, how much of it is that a serious threat about a freezing spend or a spending freeze?
Well, it's not without precedent. Former Governor Ed Rendell did that back in 2009 when budget debate dragged on into October of that year. So it's certainly something that's been done before, and frankly, it is the prudent thing to do. When you're running out of money, the first thing you do is stop the bleeding, and that includes freezing spending. I'll be curious to see where the administration starts, if they follow through on that, on what sort of spending they freeze and what kind of programs they hit. That could be a squeeze point to get things moving.
All right, we have just about a minute left, John. You alluded to 2 years ago in Governor Wolf's first budget about the 9 months without a budget. Is this stalemate on revenues going to last anywhere near that? We're a couple months into, shall we say, a stalemate there.
One hopes not. We're heading into an even numbered year here where Governor Wolf is up for re-election, the House and Senate. All 203 members of the House are up for re-election. Half of the 50-member Senate are up for re-election. I don't think any of them want to go into an election year being branded as the gang who couldn't shoot straight or couldn't get a budget together for the third year in a row. The kind of political baggage they don't want hanging around their neck.
And very quickly, is there one tax that might be more acceptable to the House than another?
If I had to guess, maybe they could cobble together the votes for a severance tax, but that could be a bit of a lift. But the gross receipts tax is a big issue for a lot of people in the House.
All righty, John. John Micek is the opinion editor for Penn Live and the Harrisburg Patriot News. John, thanks so much.
Kevin, anytime.
Coming up, Alcoa returns to its Pittsburgh roots. What does this mean for the region and the industry? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Pittsburgh Zoo's baby elephant is recovering after having a feeding tube inserted. Zoo officials say the calf was in critical condition after she stopped eating and gaining weight. It was likely due to the discomfort she felt while teething. And a third bald eagle has died from lead poisoning in Pennsylvania. A wildlife center near Erie says it can be caused by scavenging animals killed with bullets or fishing sinkers. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 11 years ago, Alcoa moved its headquarters from Pittsburgh to New York. September 1st, the aluminum maker returns to its home. What does that mean to the Pittsburgh region? What's the future of the aluminum industry and the environmental impact? We're going to discuss these questions and others with the three reporters who are working on a series of stories to air next week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Joining us in studio is reporter John Miller, who covers the metals and mining industries. Welcome, John. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Kevin. Good morning.
Also, Margaret J. Krause, WESA's development and transportation reporter. Margaret, good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And on the phone from Ohio is Julie Grant, reporter and managing editor for the Allegheny Front. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. In mid-April, Alcoa announced it would return its corporate headquarters to Pittsburgh. We're not talking about hundreds of employees coming to Pittsburgh. Start with you, John.
This is about a dozen jobs at most, and it's the top jobs. It's the CEO, Roy Harvey, and Bill Oplinger, the CFO, and the brass. And it's a cost-cutting exercise. They're saving $5 million by shutting down their office on Park Avenue, which obviously costs more than Pittsburgh, and a bunch of other offices from Nashville to Beijing to Richmond, and moving that all to Pittsburgh, where they'll run this global corporation from the North Shore.
So in a dozen or so employees, so is it, yes, cost-cutting, but is it a bunch of symbolism? And I want to ask all of you that question. But first, let's hear from Mayor Peduto. I put that question to him. He thinks it's more than symbolism.
It was a conscious decision several years ago that a company on the world stage needed to have a New York address in order to be competitive and what they wanted to portray as their image. And now that they are willing to put it back to a 152 zip code, basically states that that theory is not true.
All right. Reaction from all of you. Let's start with you, Julie. Symbolism or more than symbolism?
Well, I think Alcoa makes sense in Pittsburgh. It's a steelmaking, it's a traditional aluminum, you know, it's a heavy metal kind of a place. And so it doesn't make sense to have Alcoa based in this city.
Well, many things are true at the same time. And I think Bill Peduto's right that Pittsburgh is a place where it's easier to do business on a global stage than maybe 10 or 20 years ago. There's a whole roster of banking and legal services here. And this city has had corporate headquarters for 130 years. I mean, people talk about Pittsburgh as Steel City, but it's long been office city, too. You've often had massive companies headquartered here like Heinz and Westinghouse. And Alcoa is a global company, and it is a big deal. He's right about that. It's a company that has smelters in Saudi Arabia and Iceland and Norway, and is recognizable all over the business world, from China to Russia to Europe.
Margaret?
I mean, traditionally, this has been a place of resources, so not only of natural resources, but of people, which is partly what brought Alcoa out to New Kensington, was access to a river and flat land. And so I think it's probably, as John says, both things. It's symbolism and roots.
Before we look at the present and the future, let's take a look back, if you would. So 126 years or so, but actually it changed its name to Alcoa, I believe, in the early 1900s. They were starting work in the late 1880s in the Strip District?
So the big breakthrough for this company that became Alcoa was the invention of a modern process used to make aluminum. Before Alcoa, aluminum was a luxury good. They put it on the top of the Washington Monument in D.C. as like a kind of gold, and it was not mass producible until this process that Charles Martin Hall invented, which paved the way for things like aluminum-made beer cans and cars and airplanes. And now it's ubiquitous. It's a metal that's used in all kinds of goods. And that is thanks to this invention by the company that became Alcoa, which is celebrated by a plaque in the Strip District on Smallman Street and is something that Pittsburghers should be proud of.
Margaret?
Sure. So it moved from the Strip District to New Kensington, New Ken. And if you come over the bridge over the Allegheny River into New Kensington, the entire riverfront, well, not entire, much of it remains buildings that Alcoa used. And ultimately, part of why Alcoa left New Kensington is because it was constrained on this spit of land. So much of it remains warehouse, incubator space, and then further in, up the hill, there's a giant former Alcoa research laboratory.
So it needed more space but didn't have it?
It continued to grow. So after it relocated and opened its New Kensington Works, which it wasn't called that in 1891. But they continued to expand over the years, and then they built the Alcoa Research Laboratory in 1930 to keep pace with rapid turnaround between ideas and creation.
All right. Now, Margaret, you say, or you repeat what others say, that New Kensington is the town Alcoa built. You spoke to the mayor, Tom Guzzo?
Tom Guzzo, yes.
Guzzo.
So Alcoa certainly made New Kensington prosperous. There's no question about it.
You know, there are a group of us who stayed here to raise our families here, to work here, to do all those things. And we were here when, at the tail end of when things were ridiculously good, okay? But we now know that it's going to be a different type of downtown, but everybody's working together, and we've reached that point now where it's just, it's all going up.
New Kensington had five, this was a town at its peak that had 25,000 people. At its peak, it had five department stores, five movie theaters, and when Alcoa left, if you watch historically the numbers, employment at the production facilities kept pace with the population. They kind of followed one another through the years. And so when Alcoa left, New Kensington had to begin reasserting itself.
71?
71 is when they closed the production facilities.
It's a classic Rust Belt story, and unfortunately it's happened all over this country. Alcoa has closed a bunch of smelters. They have only two of the 10 smelters they had 10 years ago still operating in the United States. Aluminum is a very power-intensive business. 40%, up to 40% of the cost of making aluminum is power, and it's just too expensive to make it in the United States now. And so smelters are closing. And it's not very realistic that jobs in aluminum will come back to Western Pennsylvania. But this part of the country still does have human capital to manage these other smelters all over the world.
Julie, those kind of questions about the lingering impact of any heavy industry on a community, whatever the community, whatever the industry is, those questions always remain, don't they?
Yeah. You know, I used to do some reporting up in northern New York, around Messina, New York, where Alcoa still has a smelter there. It's only largely there because the state of New York is supporting it with something like $73 million in subsidies. They've had to deal with PCBs in the river that date back to the 1970s and pollution from Alcoa. At the same time, similarly to what I think Margaret was saying, this is a town that has largely existed and depended on the jobs that Alcoa provides there. So, you know, it's a balance.
I believe that smelting operation started in 1902, and they brag about it being the longest continuing such operation in the country. So the move back to Pittsburgh for its headquarters, it's not really to be close to any operations, John?
No, not really. It's because the headquarters are already there, basically, and they already had a lot of back office staff there. And we haven't talked about another company which also has a Pittsburgh presence called Arconic. Now, Arconic is the other company that was born out of Alcoa. Alcoa, 2 years ago, basically split in two. Arconic makes downstream products, what they call downstream products, like truck wheels and lightning-resistant screws for airplanes made out of fancy aluminum alloys. And it's also has a big office in Pittsburgh. Its headquarters are going to be in New York, and they've told me they have no plans to come back to Pittsburgh. But Alcoa is, and Alcoa has good reasons for being here. It already has the office here, has a research center in New Kensington, which it's splitting with Arconic. And this is interesting. Those offices are split in two, both in the North Shore and New Kensington. And for competitive reasons, they're not allowed to interact. So they have separate bathrooms, separate halls. Oh, they may have common bathrooms, I forget. But they have separate offices, but they're both here. They're both in Pittsburgh.
John, I want to follow up on something you said a little bit earlier, and that had to do with the energy-intensive nature of this industry. You said about 40% of its cost is energy. Is that correct?
Up to 40%, yeah.
Okay. So we think of Alcoa, we think of aluminum, of course, and we think of the cans, automobiles, et cetera, some things that you, that the three of you have been talking about. But the, Alcoa itself is also in the energy business, is it not? To, and that seems to be a logical follow-up.
Historically, yeah, they've owned dams, power plants. Would they go into that as a separate business? That's not something I think is in the plans. I mean, their business is still making raw aluminum products, also mining bauxite, which is the raw material that becomes aluminum, and refining it into a product called alumina, which is used in smelters to make aluminum. So you're right, there is a broad business, and power is part of it, and could be more in the future for sure.
And that one of those dams they built was in, I believe, Suriname. That was a big operation there.
That's right, and I think the Post-Gazette had a very nice series detailing.
I would just chime in there to say that the move toward hydropower from, say, coal production is one of the ways that Alcoa and other companies are touting the greening of their industry, saying that by using hydropower, they're emitting much less greenhouse gases into the air than they would when using coal production, which is largely what's happening in China. You know, the increase in the aluminum industry in China, and a lot of that is still from, even the new production is coming from coal-fired power plants, and the greenhouse gas implications of that are large.
Julie is right to bring up China. If you had to look at one factor that's changed what this company so emblematic of Pittsburgh has become, it is China. China now makes well over half the world's aluminum. It's overproduction thanks to subsidized coal power, has deflated aluminum prices, and has caused Alcoa to close these smelters in the United States. If any product has been shaken by China's rise, it has been aluminum.
And we want to talk about the competition, if you would, for Alcoa. We are talking with John Miller, reporter who covers the metals and mining industries, Margaret J. Krause, transportation and development reporter for 90.5 WESA, and Julie Grant. She's the managing editor and reporter for Allegheny Front. And we're exploring Alcoa's return to its home, its roots, as it moves its headquarters back to Pittsburgh on September 1st. I'm Kevin Gavin. This is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Margaret, I want to get back to you and John and also Julie. I mentioned that you're all doing a series of reports that will air next week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. What was the question, or what were the couple of questions that you really wanted to broach when you set out to do your stories? Julie, we'll start with you.
Well, I guess the way I've read it in some places that aluminum in general really has kind of a split personality when it comes to the environment. There are, you know, as I mentioned, it can be very greenhouse gas intensive. It can create a lot of pollution in its primary production. At the same time, when used on things like cars, it's much lighter weight than, say, steel. And so the aluminum industry likes to tout sort of the improvements in miles per gallon, that those, when used in production, it means the car will be lighter weight, it will reduce miles per gallon. And, you know, I just got off the phone just a few minutes ago with an aluminum trade group, and what they're saying is, look at our numbers. It almost balances out the greenhouse gases that we're producing in production when compared with the savings in miles per gallon when used on, when aluminum is used on cars. It's like a 92%. Almost a one-for-one. So I guess that was sort of what I wanted to look into, is sort of the balance sheet of aluminum as something that creates pollution, but something that can also save some pollution.
Margaret, what was
prevent some pollution?
Margaret, what was the key question that you wanted answered?
Sure. So if you go up a hill in New Kensington above the river, there's this beautiful jewel of a building that faces a residential neighborhood. And for nearly 50 years, that's where the most impressive research for aluminum happened. Well, they also opened the Alcoa Technical Center, so kind of where it happened mostly for 50 years. And I wanted to know, when this company that built the town, their histories parallel one another, when it left, does that mean the redevelopment of this site could help rejuvenate the city's economic well-being? Is that a new future for New Kensington thanks to the redevelopment of that site.
Oh, hold on. I got to follow up on that built the town because it actually isn't.
Because companies don't build towns.
Well, but no,
do.
The naming of the town itself, though.
Sure. So when the Pittsburgh Reduction Company went to incorporate, they said, we'd like to be in Kensington. And Harrisburg told them, see, that's kind of a rough deal. There's already a Kensington. And so they said, all right, we'll just ask the town fathers to call it New Kensington, which is what they did.
So they had the impact on the name. Yes, John.
To me, the Alcoa relocation was a really great way of looking at the character of Pittsburgh. I'm not from here. I moved here 7 years ago. And coming here, the mythology was always, this is a blue-collar city. It's a steel city. One thing that struck me moving here, this is a very prosperous city with so many like banks and law firms. And it's really a white-collar city in many ways, too, especially compared to other cities in this part of the country. And I think Alcoa's relocation, I mean, kind of shows that. I mean, this is a global company that has global name recognition, and it is choosing Pittsburgh, and it is contributing to this kind of economy of you know, consultants and managerial expertise that is in Pittsburgh.
And I think that's why going to New Kensington is so startling. Alcoa isn't going back there. And if you look at the Fifth Avenue, which is one of their downtown areas, the parking meters don't even collect change. Many of the buildings are for sale. So just miles away from Pittsburgh, there's a completely different kind of economic story on display.
Well, Margaret, you spoke with Steve Kubrick, I believe it is. Now, his company owns the old Alcoa Research Lab site.
Helping people get jobs and create jobs, and I think that's what this originally did around here, and hopefully someday it'll do it again. Right now, we're just cleaning it up and building it, so we're hopeful to get somebody, you know, like a Google or a, I don't know why Alcoa never left it, to be honest with you. It's a gorgeous place, but when we bought it, there was stuff in the desk and everything. It looked like somebody just, like, set something off and said, get the heck out the back door.
People, we talk about people giving up everything for an idea or to create something. Kubrick has poured more than $3 million into this site. He and his wife recently divorced. He's given 7 years of his life and a lot to this site. And he just really, I spoke with him recently, he just really wants to see this site provide jobs and sort of an engine for New Kensington.
Yeah. It's interesting. So you have a smaller community, New Kensington. Its population has decreased, has declined. And John, you used the term just a moment or two ago about Pittsburgh being a prosperous. It is much harder when a community is just so heavily involved in one industry, one corporation.
And I think the other important factor was the election and President Trump's promise to bring jobs back to this part of the country. And you know, however seriously you may or may not have taken that when he made it, I think it's a question that lingers in people's minds. They think maybe, you know, we could get a big, you know, trove of manufacturing jobs back in Western Pennsylvania. And that might be true, but it's not going to be from aluminum. Even if natural gas provides a boon to power prices, even if there are import tariffs on imported aluminum, it's just not competitive in this part of the country.
And you mentioned, again, I think it's worth repeating, China makes more than 50% of the aluminum?
Correct, with subsidized power from coal. And that's why Alcoa has gone after smelters now. They run smelters in Norway, in Iceland, where they have geothermal power, in Saudi Arabia, on one of the world's biggest gas fields. Those are the kinds of places you make aluminum now, not Western Pennsylvania.
To any of you, so industry, companies have to adapt. They have to evolve. Is Alcoa evolving?
It is. I mean, they have the best smelters, really. I mean, you can't be more sort of ambitious than going and chasing smelters or building factories in places like Iceland and Saudi Arabia. Can they compete? Yeah, if they keep on doing things like that. But it's going to mean sacrifice in markets that are not competitive, like in the U.S.
Margaret?
I can't speak to what Alcoa's competitive advantages are, but in New Kensington, in terms of remaining competitive, they're talking about all pulling together. There are a lot of people who are committing their time and energy to rebuilding the community. And they're looking at a mix of industry, basically, to keep the town sure-footed moving forward as opposed to relying on one big employer.
Julie, you touched a little bit on this, was sort of trying to at least demonstrate the greening of the industry. Are there substantive steps to make it a more sustainable industry or more sustainable company that you've noticed?
Yeah, there really are. I spoke yesterday with a woman from the Aluminum Stewardship Initiative. They're based in Melbourne, Australia. And Alcoa is part of this initiative. They're starting to create, by the end of the year, they hope to launch this. It's just basically a certification for, they don't use this term, but I'll use this term, for green aluminum, aluminum that meets certain standards for various sustainability goals, things like how it's produced, everything. Actually, I should start from the beginning, everything from where it's mined and how it's mined to the production process and how much energy you use in that production of the actual primary metal, and then how it's used beyond that. And Alcoa is one of the companies that is involved with the stewardship initiative. I'm not sure exactly how involved, but they as a company are one of those, you know, the top few that are often cited as having a line of products that they call a sustainable line of products, or more so, you know, a green aluminum product. And again, they don't use that term, but that's a term that's used sometimes by others. So again, they're moving in that direction. The industry as a whole, as like sort of the world economy becomes greener. And, you know, yes, we've heard that the U.S. government has pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. But, you know, as the rest of the world moves forward, you know, what I'm hearing from folks in the aluminum industry is everyone's going to move in this direction. Whatever the U.S. government is doing, business still has to move in this direction. And so Alcoa is right there with the aluminum industry in doing that.
All right. We have just about a minute and a half left, 20 seconds for each of you. What will you be keeping an eye on in the near future regarding Alcoa, the aluminum industry, New Kensington? We'll start with you, John.
I mean, I think Alcoa, again, is a big company. It's a huge deal globally. It's a company that Pittsburghers should be proud of, and they should look at what it's doing all over the world. And they still hire a lot of people here, mostly for office jobs, but it is a big employer, and Pittsburghers should be proud that its headquarters have come back.
Julie, 20 seconds, please.
I guess I'd be looking to see how they move forward with some of these green initiatives.
Margaret?
Sure. I'll be following this nearly 200,000 square feet of former Alcoa Research Laboratory site to see what it does for the city of New Kensington.
A reminder that next week during All Things Considered and Morning Edition, you can hear the week-long series of reports from the reporters you've heard on the Confluence today. Julie Grant is a reporter and managing editor for the Allegheny Front. Margaret J. Krause is development and transportation reporter for WESA. And John Miller is a reporter specializing in metals and mining. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kev.
The evolving approach and technology to journalistic storytelling. We'll talk about that next when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, 3,524 incoming Pitt freshmen break the Guinness World Record for the greatest number of people simultaneously performing an umbrella dance at a single venue in 2012. Students were honoring the 100th birthday of performer Gene Kelly, a Pitt alum known for iconic dance scenes like in the musical Singin' in the Rain. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for August 25th, 2017.
Just singing in the rain, what a glorious feeling.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. It used to be print, radio, television, three silos of journalism, if you will. But new approaches to storytelling, to reporting, to journalism are being tried and succeeding in attracting, informing, and entertaining consumers. We're going to talk about these innovative approaches and how they blend with the traditional with Adil Guzda. She's a multidisciplinary designer and art director from Brussels, now based in Pittsburgh, recently working with Public Source's Small Town PA series. Welcome, Adil.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also in studio is Amy Jo Brown, data and investigative journalist, designer, and co-founder of War Streets Media. Welcome, Amy Jo.
Thank you.
And Ben Howard is the assistant managing editor for digital design with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back to the show, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation. Please tweet us your comments or questions and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, to each of you, are those walls of the silos of journalism that I referred to, are they completely broken through now? Is there still any resistance? Who wants to start? Ben?
Yeah, sure. They're
pretty close to being broken down all the way, I'd say. I mean, there's people, reporters, photographers. I mean, everybody is, you know, combining efforts to do really good work now. So, you know, we've been talking about this a lot at work, and, you know, reporters are taking video and photos and doing a really good job with it. You can do magic with your phone these days. So, yeah, it's definitely starting to break down.
I think it depends on what you mean by the silos, right? Mm-hmm. I think what you are seeing is that it's particularly in the way that newsrooms are functioning today, it's much harder to be a reporter and be singularly focused on a single beat. I am an advocate for we need more of that, and we need to figure out that people can't do everything and do it well at the same time. But I do think that there's a lot more collaboration that ends up happening in that process. So you do have reporters who should be working a lot more closely with developers and designers, and editors should very much understand and know what the designers and developers are doing as much as they do their reporters. Being able to understand that code or read that code or ask good questions is super necessary. And so I think we are getting to a point where it is more complex. You need people with more specialized skills. And, you know, and so that multidisciplinary team is certainly a part of today's journalism.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. I think in a design sense, I'm personally more drawn to illustrating and creating visuals for real stories out there than trying to sell a product, for example. Because I feel like a lot of designers start out in advertising with that main message. But I think there's really like a big push into that direction as of late. I definitely notice it.
The consumers of the information, are they behind this? Have they forced us? Are they forcing our industry to evolve? Or are there some creative folks like yourselves sort of pulling everybody along? What do you think?
I think it's the business model that's forcing change. I mean, but most fundamentally, you know, I mean, we can't rely on the advertising dollars to support our work. So we need to start thinking a lot more about our readers and how we are meeting their needs or not meeting their needs. I think that, you know, traditionally there was a lot of feeling that we knew best. And I still think that we hold a position that is, you know, a very valuable position. But I do think that we can't, our customers are no longer the businesses. I think that our customers are truly our readers now.
I would agree. And I think they expect a certain user interface that is easy to understand and consume. So I think I think readers, consumers are driving that aspect of it. They expect things, you know, online. So we have to be cognizant of that, and we have to design good product, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And for me as a designer, I just like to include kind of like the imperfection side of creating those visuals to engage people into being part of that medium.
I want to follow up with what Adil just said, and I want to get a sense of, I know it's a broad question, but I get a sense of how you tackle an idea. You know, tell me a little bit about your creative process. Amy, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I work quite a bit with large data sets at the moment. And I say large, you know, we're talking about public data in local government. So it's not large on Google's scale of large. But it's more than what you can handle in a typical worksheet or spreadsheet.
Right.
So, I mean, a lot of it is actually pretty traditional. You know, you're interviewing the data. You have to truly understand where it's coming from, who collected it, how it was put together, how the people who entered that data interpreted it. So even though there might have been, you know, some rules set down on paper, that doesn't necessarily mean it happened that way. So you still have to do quite a bit of reporting behind the scenes to understand that. And then you're often doing a lot of cleaning work. So in terms of the creativity, there's a quip that often I hear from the folks doing this kind of work, and that's 80% of your time is going to be spent cleaning the data, which is not very creative.
Come on, where's the fun part coming?
Right, right. And then 20% you actually do get to dig into how are you going to tell this story.
story and based on what you found.
And you?
Well, my process to put down facts into visuals really comes down to having access to the story, even if it's on a draft stage, just because things move really like linearly. Like, you know, we have an article and we need an image for that, you know, tomorrow. My process would be to really start highlighting all the key elements and keywords that kind of like stroke up an image, visual. And then from that, I will try to bring almost like opposite facts just to describe the like the difference of something that needs to represent something else. So whenever you see two opposite imageries, you can really like tell the story.
So you're seeing the opposite, yeah. And so therefore, because they're opposite, you understand the overall context.
Exactly. Yes. It's hard to describe it with words, but visually, it all adds up. Yes. Okay. So that would be my process.
Yeah, for me, it's always starts with research. It's just seeing what other good work is out there, seeing what other ideas people are coming up with, and trying to implement those. Like, a deal might have this really amazing illustration that's animated. I'm like, that's really sweet. Like, mm-hmm. We should do more of that. And, you know, New York Times and Washington Post do just incredible work, especially, you know, with data visualization. They're really leading the charge. So that's where I start. And then once we have an idea, to me, it's always about how do we make it more engaging? How do we get people to actually to read your story, but also interact with it, you know. So those are kind of the challenges, and those are fun challenges.
I tell my college journalism students and interns here at WESA, no matter what medium that you are employing, it's about providing a clear, understandable, accessible story, a good story. Amy Jo, I noticed on your website, mm-hmm. says there's a message. It says, editor, words, data, strategy. It's all about the story. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind to each of you, what motivates you? How do you find out? How do you figure out what's the best way to deliver your message, your story? Amy Jo.
It starts with the questions you have. I mean, it's just really, really good reporting, right? You get in and you have to understand your beat. You have to understand where your curiosity is taking you. What is getting you interested in the first place? Where are questions arising that you want to explore deeper? I think whether you're starting with data or a story or any of that, it's all coming from that same place. You can't tell an interesting story with numbers unless there's actually a story there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Content's always king, always has been, always will be. And then it doesn't matter how cool we make something look. If it's not interesting story-wise, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I agree. Story and content has a lot to do with the drive of inspiration. So for me, any story that has a really big impact, it drives me to come up with visual solutions to explain, propel the story further.
Yes. I want to talk, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, and I want to talk a little bit more about the collaboration, sort of the mm-hmm. teamwork to put the full story together mm-hmm. so that it is the best it can possibly be. And whether you want to cite one of your particular projects, I hope you will, mm-hmm. as examples, whether it's the Odysseys project of the Post-Gazette Ben or the small town Pennsylvania project mm-hmm. with Public Source that you've been working on, or Amy Jo, a particular project you've been working on. Talk a little bit about that collaboration. Where does it start? Does it start from, you know, the idea process and then move completely on, if you would?
Yeah, sure. Well, with Odysseys, that was a really amazing project we did a few years ago with Andrew McGill was a developer. He's now at The Atlantic, developer and reporter. yeah, and he also worked with Mila Sanina, who's the editor right. at Public Source. on that, and it was they did a great job. But the so you know they had the idea they wanted to interview immigrants from every country that live in Pittsburgh,
right.
Every country around the world,
right?
And they had that idea they wanted to do video, but like how do you portray that? Like do you just put them on a sheet, you know, like a grid, like but. They came back to us in the art department, and we thought, well, it would be really cool if you had a globe and you could just click on a country and you could see them. And so that's how the process started.
And it's a rotating globe that
you
can see.
You can drag the globe around and select what you want to see. And you know, we kind of worked with them to style it up, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, because you can have the individual story, which is nice. Meet these individuals, why they came to Pittsburgh, but that added component that really does something,
right.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Amy Jo, what about the collaborative process in you?
So my process, particularly for the very large project that I'm working on right now, it started as sort of an independent project. I was as a reporter, kind of looking at something and wanted to explore it. And then as that kind of grew and I realized that I needed that it wasn't something I could handle on my own. So I brought in a bunch of other people. So I work very closely with a visual designer, Lindsay Quinter, who's just awesome. Larissa Dugkowicz, she's a reporter. She kind of helps us kind of get some data entry together and to fact check it. And we've had a couple of other folks who have just really pitched in and helped. So at various times, it's just, I think, working with some of the data. If you attempt to do it alone, you might spend years. and you won't get very far. You need other people to kind of help you push it forward. It just, some of these data projects just get too big for one person to handle.
Adil, how did you work with a reporter, say, for instance, the dilemma of shrinking schools for public source?
Well, the full series of The Small Town Pennsylvania, it really started with like a series of articles that were designated to the small towns of Pennsylvania. So I got brought on a little after the articles had been written. So I would basically be assigned to an article and start working with the managing editor, Haley, and the in-house interactive design editor, Natasha. And we would start discussing the key points of the article itself. And I would list keywords that I think would translate visually, and then I would share some sketches with them, and we would talk about our favorites and which ones make the most, which ones are the most impactful or like get recognized right away, and then from that point on, I would just start illustrating and move on to animation.
Your animations are fantastic.
Thank you so much. They really are.
Check them out at Public Source. We have just a minute to go, less than a minute ago, 20 seconds for each of you. Mm-hmm. What's next? What are you cooking up? What's next? Amy Jo, real fast.
Okay. We're going to be launching at Grants Hill, and it's a publication that will be very much focused on the business of governing, and will be focused on Pittsburgh and Allegheny County local governments.
All right. Adil?
Cool. I'm currently freelancing on a couple of other projects. Another one that's related to telling stories visually is basically creating design for an app that is to combat sex assaults on campus based in LA.
Right.
I'm really excited about this climate change project we have going on that we're working on about really what it means to Pittsburghers in Western Pennsylvania. Julian Routh and Zach Tanner have been working on that, so look for that coming out soon.
All right. Adil Gozda is a multidisciplinary designer. Amy Jo Brown is a data investigative journalist, co-founder of War Streets Media. And Ben Howard is the assistant managing editor for digital design with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks, folks, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer for this week's Confluence is Katie Blackley. I'm Kevin Gavin. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.